using a 21 centimeter radiation, although some things I'll talk about ultimately work on this, but it's an idea. I know most of the discussion up to this point has been on variation of the fine structure constant, but there are other important parameters that can vary, and one of the ones that might be the easiest from a theoretical perspective to consider having a variation is neutrino mass on cosmological or environmental timescales. And so what I want to take you through today is the basic proposal of how this might arise and what some of the signatures might be. And I know that it's the end of a very stressful and tiring workshop, so I'll try to keep things light. So this is the proposal. The proposal is originally coming about from the idea that you could connect neutrinos and neutrino mass to the idea of dark energy. And this arises either directly or indirectly from the presence of a new force between these neutrinos. And the questions that I want to address are, how would a scenario like this arise? What are the theoretical and dynamical issues? And most importantly, the experimental tests. And just in case you doze off, let me summarize right now. We're going to find that, generally speaking, a cosmologically varying neutrino mass is actually very hard to test. Even if it is an exciting idea. But there is a motivation to consider matter dependence in neutrino mass, and that is much more testable. And that there are some related ideas to the dark matter power spectrum if, in fact, the neutrino mass is varying on cosmological time. So let's begin with the nature of acceleration. I know you've already talked quite a bit about the cosmological constant, but let me just begin with Pauli, who introduced the neutrino. Since I'm talking about neutrinos, let me start with there. And he said, as he predicted it, I've done a terrible thing. I have postulated a particle which cannot be detected. And this is an attitude that particle theorists have since gotten over. But this is sort of the problem when you talk about the cosmological constant, which is that it's this fantastically exciting idea, but if it ends up just being a cosmological constant, it's going to be very difficult to actually probe. So even if the ideas that we have on dynamical origins of the cosmological constant are speculative or difficult to implement, they are the only place that we're going to get some sort of empirical handle on it. So you can look at it and say, well, perhaps it's a cosmological constant from the string landscape. Maybe it's a quintessence. It might be modifications of gravity at the Hubble scale. But the approach that I'm going to follow and the basic idea I'm going to take is that if you look at the size of the cosmological constant in natural units, it's about 10 to the minus 3 electron volts. And every time that we've seen a scale of physics appear in nature, whether it's a GeV, roughly 400 MeV, the QCD scale, or whether it's the spectrum of atomic lines in atoms, or the mass of the W boson, any of these things, these always correspond to some new interesting physics. And so the idea and the approach that I'm going to follow is that this 10 to the minus 3 electron volts is itself, in fact, a fundamental scale in physics, and that there should be some sector out there that has this scale of physics. So how would we probe that? Well, to probe that, I have to talk about the cosmic coincidence. I think you've all heard of the cosmic coincidence, but let me just remind you. Cosmic coincidence is that on May 15th, 1988, or 1998, there was the first paper from the Filipenko-Reese high Z supernova team. And then September 8, 1998, you had the Supernova Cosmology Project team. And right in between them, you had the Super Kamiokande evidence for neutrino mass from atmospheric neutrino oscillations. And this is an amazing coincidence that we should have been waiting all this time and that these two discoveries be made within just a few months of each other. So they must obviously have something to do with each other. I kid, but it's important to note that coincidences sometimes are just coincidences. But the coincidence that I want to exploit is the fact that the neutrino mass, which is roughly of the mil-EV scale, is the same scale, in fact, that the cosmological constant appears to be. And so they already are sort of pointing us in a direction that they could at least be related in some sort of theoretically natural way. So we find ourselves in the position of these archaeologists looking at this milli-EV scale and saying, well, this could be the discovery of, it was certainly the discovery of last century to find some of the most important discoveries of the last century were to find neutrino mass and the cosmological constant. And the question of whether this is the discovery of the 21st century depends on how far down this millielectron volt scale goes. So let's begin, before I actually address the questions of neutrino mass, let's begin with the question of any masses varying. And the important thing is that every mass that we actually know is, in fact, a varying mass, right? No mass that we have is truly a fundamental constant. Protons and hadrons, they're composites, and their masses vary with the QCD scale. Quarks and leptons, as well as W and Z bosons, get their masses from the Higgs-Vev. And so the question of whether or not masses vary is really not a question at all. It's really just a question of how much the masses will vary. And we know, for instance, that if I were to put the universe at very, very high densities, roughly inverse 100 GeV densities to the fourth, then I know that the Higgs-Vev would actually shift, and all the masses of the quarks, leptons, Ws, and Zs would change. So you know that if you put the system at a finite density and that that density has a scale which is comparable to the dynamical scale, then you expect that the masses will vary. And that's important because if we believe that the fundamental new scale in the theory is milliEV, the universe presently is roughly at milliEV density, and so it could cause masses to vary. So let's think from a theoretical perspective of what a natural mass to vary would be, and we'll find very quickly that we're directed to thinking about neutrinos. So if I were to just imagine that I have any fermion, and you can repeat this with scalar fields, but if you imagine that you have any fermion, and you just say, well, I'm going to assume that its mass, which is in fact a scalar, is a dynamical field, then that dynamical field should have a potential. And it doesn't matter that this is not a canonically normalized scalar field. I can still calculate the Kolmann-Weinberg effective potential. This is the same diagram that one often sees in particle theory talks on supersymmetry, but it's the same thing here. And that is, if I imagine that I have this mass, there should be some potential that's generated through loops of the fermion field, and it has a form that looks like this. So oftentimes people will neglect this quadratic piece and say something like supersymmetry compositeness, so I'll allow ourselves to do that, but we're still stuck with this second piece here. You expect a piece in the potential, and this should really be 32 pi squared, but don't worry about that. If it's direct, it's 16. So even if you ignore this first term, you automatically expect to have a term in your potential that goes like mass to the fourth. So if you then say, well, I'm going to take this potential of mass to the fourth and put it at a finite density, and a finite density, which is roughly the cosmological density of 10 to the minus 3 eV, then you automatically find a shift in the mass which scales with the density of the universe and with the mass, I'm assuming m-naught is the mass at the current point in the universe background. So if you want to have an order one variation in this mass on cosmological timescales, you're automatically directed to the fact that the mass scale, which could be varying, should be of the order of 10 to the minus 3 eV. So it doesn't matter so much whether or not you're directly following all the technical naturalness arguments, but the idea is that if you just consider radiative stability and technical naturalness from a theoretical point of view and ask what sorts of mass parameters could vary by order one based on present cosmological densities, you're automatically pointed to mass scales which are 10 to the minus 3 eV or smaller, and the particle that we know that has a mass that is in this range is the neutrino. Yes? It's going to be something different, ultimately. It's not an effective mass in that sense. It's going to be an actual mass, but just responding to the finite. So there will be a VEV in the system, which is causing the mass. It'll be a little bit clearer when I get to the specific moment. So there are a lot of reasons to consider neutrinos beyond just that. You have the fact that the scales are appropriate, but if you want to consider a connection between neutrinos and dark energy, you also note that the relic neutrinos, the finite density element, which is actually going to be relevant for understanding this varying mass, have a relatively smooth background, which is very similar to dark energy. And this is smoothness of the neutrino background is precisely what made it a bad candidate for dark matter. And the last reason why we're thinking about neutrinos in particular, aside from the numerological ones, is that because neutrinos have no conserved quantum numbers in the low energy theory, they don't have an electric charge or a baryon number, they may have a lepton number, then they can naturally mix with fermions in the dark sector. So if I believe over here that I have some 10 to the minus 3 eV, some milliEV new dynamics, and over here I have the standard model, and I ask, what is the first type of interaction that I could have between the standard model and this new sector? The first interaction that you could think about having would be a neutrino mixing with it, because there's no conserved number that prevents that.
Interacting with the dark sector.
So the only other renormalizable operator, the renormalizable operator you can write if you have a hidden sector, right, is h star h phi star phi, if you imagine that phi is some hidden sector scale field.
You can also write FBU prime.
And you can, if there's a gauge field, you can write FBU prime. Yes, that's right.
But there are three possibilities.
Yes.
Theory.
Yes, that's it. Let me take you a little bit more into how the model works. We already, even in the standard model with neutrino masses, expect that the neutrino mass should be dynamical. The Dirac mass, the usual mass scale mass that you see written down for the neutrino, is the seesaw mass, which is the Dirac mass, the left-right mass of the neutrino squared, divided by the right-handed mass, which I'm parameterizing by lambda a. And so we already believe that the neutrino mass in the standard model should be dynamical, that the numerator should depend on the Higgs VEV, and that the denominator should depend on some other VEV. I'm calling this VEV here A, the acceleron. And usually people take the idea that this mass scale here, lambda A, is very, very high, something like 10 to the 15 GeV or so. And since I'm going to be thinking about dynamics which are happening late in the universe, I'm thinking about a situation where lambda A is very low. So we're going to be, instead of integrating out some fermion, which is gut scale mass, we're going to be integrating out neutrinos, right-handed neutrinos, which are about EV in mass. So what happens to a system like this if you put it at finite density? Well, if you'll, since the system is not any longer in thermal equilibrium, you have a very simple way of understanding it. You have a contribution to the energy density, which is the scalar potential, whatever energy is associated with the scalar field, which is the determining the mass of the neutrino. And you have the energy density in the neutrinos themselves. So this is just the number density of neutrinos times the mass neutrinos. So this is just the energy density in non-relativistic mass of neutrinos, and then this is just the energy density in the scalar potential. And the idea is that if you look at the first term in this potential here, it goes inversely like A. So this term is minimized when the A goes to large values, and so it likes to drive neutrinos to have very small masses. We assume that this potential typically likes to drive A to small values, so it's trying to drive neutrinos to large masses. And so you end up with a competition between two effects. You have this curve here, which is the scalar potential trying to push things down. And you have the finite background of neutrinos, which are trying to push things up. And when you combine them together, you get some complete effective potential, which likes to stabilize the neutrino mass at some intermediate point. As the universe evolves, though, you know that the number density of neutrinos should change just because they're diluting. And when this occurs, this sort of orangey, rusty line moves down, and this the point where we're sitting actually will move to smaller values, which will push the neutrino mass up. And the important point is that in a system like this, the total energy density does not actually redshift like A cubed. It does not redshift like matter of non-relativistic matter, but can redshift in some other ways, and so can give you something that looks like dark energy. So what are the theoretical questions you have to worry about in this case? Well, the theoretical questions you have to worry about are, first of all, the equation of state in the forms of potentials. Do you actually get something that looks like dark energy? There's radiative stability questions. So am I going to have a theory where I don't have to fine-tune my parameters in order to keep the potential flat enough to get this to work out? It turns out that this works very easily if you go to something like gauge mediation. There are cosmological dynamics questions. Something NIAGE pointed out with collaborators is that attraction between neutrinos, if they're non-relativistic, can cause them to form neutrino nuggets. But if you go to the hybrid models that we proposed with supersymmetry, where the neutrinos are relativistic instead of non-relativistic, that stabilized. Takahashi and Tanimoto also proposed that you can add some additional terms to the system. So that's just sort of the motivation in the background system, but I think the most important thing is to focus on what are the things that we can actually observe. And unfortunately, if you have a cosmologically varying neutrino mass, there are actually very few model-independent consequences. You know that the neutrinos should actually vary on cosmological timescales, but that's very difficult to actually detect. In general, these theories to predict the presence of sterile neutrinos at the EV scale, so that's something that can be looked for. And as we'll see shortly, there's a strong motivation to consider new matter effects. obviously you don't want to populate those star neutrinos. That's actually a bit much, much easier in this system not to populate them because... It's not just that you call it small, it's that because you have the varying mass, at earlier times in the universe, that sterile neutrino is much, much heavier. So the mixing angle, the same effect that I'm talking about here, if you go to higher densities, will push that neutrino to higher masses. And so the mixing angle between it and the light state is much, much smaller, and so it ends up not being populated. And in some theories, it's just always above the temperature scale, so it can never actually, you never actually even produce that mass eigenstate, you only produce the light mass eigenstate.
So does this strong neutrino interact with the acceleron, or?
Which one? The sterile. Yes. Yes.
So it also then clusters in nuggets, or?
Well, you don't actually have sterile neutrinos cosmologically populated.
Okay. So
it's saying that physically they're not there, right?
Yeah.
Because you can arrange that they're always heavier than the temperature. So
and from BDN constraints, we already know that we should just have...
What are the implications? You can produce them in colliders?
Oh, no, you see them in oscillation experiments.
I see.
So the cosmological consequences, like I said, the neutrino mass should actually vary on cosmological timescale. So the only hope that you would have in detecting something like this is if you actually did something like a tritium experiment or a measurement of the neutrino mass terrestrially and found a value which was in conflict with what we know from cosmology. Another possibility is that you actually saw cosmic ray neutrinos and that there's going to be a resonant annihilation of cosmic neutrinos with background, or with the high energy neutrinos with the background neutrinos, and at that point could actually shift at different points in the universe because the neutrino mass would actually be changing. This is very, very difficult to see because I think just seeing the resonant neutrino annihilation, just seeing high-energy cosmic neutrinos from AGNs would be hard to know. There are also some hopes that maybe high-energy cosmic rays should be seen with flavor-changing effects, but that assumes that you actually have a sense of what the flavor should be of the incident high-energy cosmic ray neutrinos anyway. So I think that looking at cosmological consequences of just varying neutrino mass on its own are very, very hard to pick out. So you have to go through some other motivations, some other ideas.
So in this formula where you have lambda and a, lambda is order 1 and a order 10 to minus 3?
That's right. Yeah. So let's consider this possibility of what kind of matter effects can you have in this picture, which are technically natural. So to have matter effects, you assume that the field that we already know could vary and depend also on the neutrino mass. So I'm, again, not treating this as a canonically normalized scalar field. I'm just treating the fact that the neutrino mass is dynamical means I can put it in this form. And the scale, the suppression scale, you would expect to be something like the Planck scale. So the idea is that the neutrino mass, if it's some random scalar field, could also influence baryon masses or quark and lepton masses. And if so, then it would have some shift when you put it into finite density of matter. So you can play the exact same game we had before, where you calculate what the shift, if you have a potential due to finite density effects, so 10 to the 19 eV to the fourth is roughly the typical density of matter of 3 grams per cubic centimeter. So if you put, if you look at how this field responds to the presence of finite density of matter with a scale of mass which is 10 to the minus 4 eV, which is the largest mass that I can have and have this work, and if you plug in that these interactions should be gravitationally suppressed, you find that the neutrino mass will shift by about 1.1 electron volts. So the upshot of all that, I don't think it's important that you go through all the direct arguments, is that you can have incredibly weak interactions. You can have gravitationally suppressed interactions between the scalar field and ordinary matter, and yet the shift in neutrinos will still be comparable to the mass scale of neutrinos that we already know. And this is something, in fact, that we already knew. The lesson of the seesaw, right? The seesaw is a situation where you're integrating out Planck scale particles almost, and you're finding that these are the dominant contribution to neutrino mass. So the lesson of the history of neutrino mass is that you can have incredibly weak forces and that they can be the dominant effects in neutrino propagation. And this goes all the way back to Lincoln-Wolfenstein, who also talked about exactly these sort of scalar interactions when he first put forward his oscillations in matter paper. So what kind of effects might show up then? Well, as I argued, these kinds of matter effects are the leading order effects that you would have if you started thinking about the relationship between charged matter, except for the FNU new term and the Higgs mixing. And if you calculate what kind of neutrino mass shift you should have in the actual acceleron model that I talked about before, then you parameterize the acceleron model I talked about before with some terms lambda nu, which could be roughly this size, lambda b, which should be about 10 to the minus 2 to satisfy the constraints from equivalence principle measurements. And putting in a mass of the acceleron of about 10 to the minus 6 eV, you find that you can shift neutrino masses by an electron volt. So the point of all of this exercise is just that it's very reasonable, if there is a new scale of physics, which is at the milli-eV scale, if that couples to the standard model, that you could have shifts of order an electron volt and see those in neutrino oscillation experiments. So this is a quick summary of all of the neutrino oscillation experiments. And this is by Zirk in 04. And she distinguishes between high-density matter and air. And the important point is that if you look at all of the neutrino experiments, all of the neutrino oscillation experiments, they all of the experiments which actually have shown an indication of neutrino oscillations have been propagating through high-density materials. They've been propagating through Earth and not through air. So it's amazing that at this point in time, even though we know a tremendous amount about neutrinos already, we cannot definitively say that neutrinos have mass in air. We only have definitive evidence that neutrinos have mass in matter. And that's a big deal, because you would think that we would know a lot more than that. But we don't. I'm not actually advocating that the neutrinos don't have mass in air, but the fact that we don't know that they don't have mass in air is a big deal. The only experimental evidence so far which has studied this has been the Supercomiokande collaboration, which has some path length in air for downward-going neutrinos, which is relevant. And in studying those, they find that there is still a best fit. Zero would be no matter dependence. A best fit, which is very close to no matter dependence, but that there is a wide range of matter dependences which are still left. They've come from the sun, but the point is that the principal oscillation effects that you actually expect for solar neutrinos are within the sun itself. So given that we understand the solar neutrino oscillations from their propagation through high-density material, the subsequent oscillation through space actually doesn't contribute very much. So that doesn't give us any indication that there is neutrino mass in free space. If it had been a more of a just-so solution, where we've been in very small mass scales, then that would have given us evidence that neutrinos had mass. But it's principally large-angle MSW. So what sorts of signals could you have of mass varying in matter? Well, people have already pointed out that if you combine the different solar neutrino measurements, you have different sources of neutrinos. And it's often argued that the beryllium neutrinos seem to be coming out anomalously low and a bad fit to the large mixing angle of atmospheric neutrinos. So these are two papers by these authors who studied the possibility of matter effects and neutrino mass varying in matter, and compared the large mixing angle solution, which is this very slow change. So, I should explain what I'm plotting here. This is the survival probability of a neutrino, so the probability that something that starts an electron neutrino stays an electron neutrino as a function of the neutrino energy on the x-axis, because you can measure neutrinos at the different energies. And then these points are the extracted values for the different sources of neutrinos. And you can see that if you could look at these beryllium neutrinos right in the middle, that they seem to disagree or agree marginally with the large mixing angle solution. And this might be some indication for additional matter effects. So if we want to get a handle on whether there could possibly be any more matter effects going on that are affecting neutrino propagation, then getting a good measurement of the beryllium neutrino flux is going to be key, because that's the only thing that is showing any tension at the present moment, and pinning it down is.
This is just one signal. Yeah.
If you look at the overall fit, it's actually worse than that, but yeah.
But the last point, that's the bigger discrepancy.
Oh, the boron neutrinos? Yeah, it does. This is the best fit point. But the reason why the point, this curve here is pulled by the presence of these beryllium neutrinos, and it's very hard to get. That's why the curve is an overall bad fit, is it's being pulled by this point.
Beryllium is just electron capture.
What's that?
It's just electron capture on the beryllium center.
Yeah.
So I don't understand. So the large mixing angle, there is no free parameter there.
This is the best fit. This is the best fit large mixing angle solution right here.
Ah, this is the best fit.
And in this plot, it goes through.
Oh.
So I don't know, but Gonzalez Garcia is very good, so. Other possible experimental tests of these matter effects would be in short reactor neutrinos and short baseline experiments. This is actually probably your best handle on whether or not neutrino masses vary in environments at all, because you really have the ability to control the environment that they propagate through. So you could imagine doing something like the Diabay neutrino experiment, where you have neutrinos propagating through a wide number of different media. So they go through air, they go through matter, and you can combine all of those data and see whether or not there's any sort of matter effect. There's also the possibility of looking at double show, where you have a where you measure the flux of neutrinos at two sources, and then you can actually put some sort of matter between the source and the target and see whether or not it changes. So these sorts of experiments, which are going to be the next round of neutrino experiments, should give us some sort of definitive information on whether or not neutrino masses vary in matter. One exciting cosmological consequence is the idea that the neutrino mass varies in a slightly different way from what I described, but that there is some late-time phase transition in the universe. That early on in the universe, the neutrino mass is stuck. If I'm thinking of neutrino mass as a scalar field, that the neutrino mass is stuck at some point by some sort of finite temperature effective potential, but that when I cool the universe down, this barrier disappears and it can begin oscillating. And so in a model like this, you actually convert the neutrino background energy, this cosmological constant, into a dark matter, and you can look at the properties of this dark matter. And one of the important properties of this dark matter is that it actually should form, so to speak, around a scale of an electron volt. So prior to that era, the dark matter would just be some sort of cosmological constant, and then at some late time, when the neutrino mass began varying, it would turn into dark matter. This is, of course, important because if you have matter which doesn't actually become matter until late times, then it doesn't evolve and it doesn't cluster like matter at early times, which means that if you look at the power spectrum of matter, you can possibly see breaks in the matter power spectrum at small scales. So I'm just looking at plots, not unlike the plots we saw in the previous talk, where we look at the matter power as a function of the scale factor, and you expect cold dark matter to have power which extends all the way down to small scales. That's because it can be gravitationally clustering at early times, even during radiation domination. But if the dark matter actually formed from a neutrino phase transition at late times, then you would expect a high suppression of power.
So what is the temperature at which you form this, this dark matter?
Generally, it's going to go with something like in the model that we looked at, it goes something like M23 over G squared, where G squared is some, or over alpha, where alpha is some perturbative coupling. So if alpha is something like it is in the standard model, if it's like 1 over 137, then you would expect the transition to occur at something like 10 eV. So the scale, if you convert that into the scale factors that we actually found, were if you vary the parameters, you find that the scale where you expect the break of the power spectrum to go something from 10 to the minus 3 to 10 to the 2. An age inverse megaparsec. And this is even more speculative, but since we're on this tack, let me just say that if you have this sort of a theory of dark matter, it does not, even once you form it, it does not redshift in the usual way, and that it might contribute to some additional tilt to the power spectrum or modifications to the late-time ISW effects. So let me quickly summarize. I think that I know that everything I'm talking about here is a speculative model, but the idea, I think, is very robust. The idea is just, let's take this milli-EV scale seriously and think about what the consequences of that milli-EV scale would be for cosmology. Because if there is a fundamental milli-EV scale, and we are at milli-EV densities now, then we actually expect the system to be responding to the finite density that we have to perceive. And if that is an important scale, just like if 100 GeV is an important scale and you expect a phase transition at 100 GeV, it's not unreasonable to expect there was some sort of phase transition in the recent history of the universe. So that's my first point, just that when you look at dark energy and you see this milli-EV scale out there, this motivates us to consider new physics at that energy scale. And then if you want to probe this, Maxine's point about photon-boson prime mixing notwithstanding, neutrinos are really the ideal probe because they're so sensitive to very, very weak effects. These sorts of interactions generically lead to a very massive neutrino, and that can be varying on cosmological time scales, or it can be on in the context of matter effects. If you want to test these sorts of theories, the first place to look is neutrino oscillation experiments, because if the neutrino actually mass can vary, then you should see the effect of that varying mass when you compare one experiment to another and air to Earth oscillations. And if you have late time phase transitions in the universe that give rise to dark matter in these theories, then you expect a significant break in the power spectrum. And when you actually do these 21 centimeter measurements, then you might have indication of this sort of an effect. So all of these things may point to scale new physics 10 to the minus 3 eV, and hopefully we're in a situation like this. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
Acceleron potential is very flat.
It's very flat, but it's not flat like quintessence flat.
Okay.
Right? Quintessence flat requires you to have a potential which is 10 to the minus 33 eV.
Do you expect any fluctuations of acceleron generated during the inflation at all?
It's not light.
It's not light, huh?
It's not
very heavy.
It's, well,
I mean, compared to any cosmological Hubble constant, it's right. I think so.
It's 10 to the minus 3 eV. It's 10 to the minus 3 eV or so, or 10 to the minus 4 eV. But that's certainly higher or lower than the Hubble scale at very, very early times.
Right.
So you do expect fluctuations. Those fluctuations would have presumably died out. I mean, because they'll just oscillate like ordinary matter.
So they would be a redshift.
They would redshift just like ordinary matter. So unless you expect in this sense, it just becomes a moduli problem, right? If you have a scalar field which oscillates, then the first thing you need to do is make sure that it doesn't overclose the universe. But once you have that, then I think that these things will just dictate.
That's my generic problem with it, because you went somehow to be 10 to the minus 3 eV, right? And you inflation naturally pushes it to the Hubble scale at inflation.
I think the mass could be much larger at much higher.
You could pretty easily make it larger.
Yeah, you can couple it directly to the inflaton to get rid of that. Yes, I agree with that. But then you would lose the technical naturalness of flattening light.
I could also couple it just to the curvature tensor, right? And generate a Hubble scale mass for it, and then it would be fine.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Could you please remind atomic audience, what do we really know about neutrino? I mean, not this possibilities of depending on some dark matter or whatever. So I heard that first we even are not sure that neutrino has a mass in conventional sense. First I was told that experimental data could be described with three left neutrino and two right neutrino.
That's right.
Another option is that first neutrino mass is not small, it's about the same as electron if we speak about the direct mass, but the right neutrino has a huge Majorana mass, and that also agree with the data. So in a sense, we are not sure that neutrons have a small mass in the conventional sense.
In the books.
So we only know some mixing.
I'll use blue. So the point is that if you actually look at neutrino mass, there are two independent measurements of neutrino mass that are out there. You have the atmospheric and the solar measurements.
Mass or mixing?
What you actually have measurements for are neutrino oscillations. So you have measurements for neutrinos oscillating, right? So you have something like this, right? And this here gives you a measurement of the mass splitting between two neutrinos. Okay, so you're actually measuring mass splitting when you measure out, if you interpret it as neutrino mass.
But what should happen if neutrino has a mass like mega electron volt and huge, but right neutrino has huge direct mass?
Right. So
it would be the same or not?
It would. Well, so let me be very specific about what I mean. So this first of all is just a measurement of mass differences, right? So we have two measurements. Essentially, we have the atmospheric, and we have the solar. And but the important point is, what is the
atmospheric and solar neutrino from experimental? Atmospheric is all directions, you mean?
Atmospheric neutrinos are dominantly muon neutrinos when they're produced because you bombard the upper atmosphere with.
And from cosmic rays.
From cosmic rays, which produce pylons, which produce neutrinos.
Solar neutrinos are neutrinos which go through the Earth in order to get right off the ground.
So
this is what you mean.
The principal difference is that solar neutrinos are produced from nuclear process in the sun, and so are dominantly electron neutrinos. Yeah. Whereas atmospheric neutrinos are produced from pion decays, and producing muons, which produce muon neutrinos.
But experimental difference is that we like to have right of space.
So
the neutrino use Earth as a shield, or?
So the principal difference is that cosmic ray neutrinos come from every direction.
Yes.
Solar neutrinos only come from the sun. Solar neutrinos are in the MeV range, whereas cosmic neutrinos are in the GeV range.
Okay.
And then there's the principal flavor composition of them.
Okay.
Also, cosmic ray neutrinos, because you can look at them in all directions, give you many baselines, and that allows you to measure these oscillation frequencies much better. But with regard to this other point, since we only have two measurements of mass differences, and this, obviously the difference between this and this, this mass difference and this mass difference are very similar, you only need to have two massive neutrinos in your theory, even though you have three neutrinos. So one could be massless, and that would be consistent with the data. The second point that you're making, which is about whether or not you could have a mass which is similar to the electron mass, is just the seesaw mechanism. And the idea is just that if you have a mass matrix that looks like this, where you have an off-diagonal element, which is, you know, GeV, and then you have a diagonal element, which is 1016 GeV, that you diagonalize that, and then you have, all right, so. But you never produce this state. You only produce this state. You only produce a mass eigenstate. You don't ever produce interaction eigenstates. So.
But still, we don't know that we have a simple picture from neutrino mass, and we don't know which picture we have.
Yeah,
so
but
we just know that the older picture with only left neutron is in.
It's a legitimate low-energy degree of freedom. You never excite right-handed neutrinos, right? I mean, it's only the left-handed neutrinos propagate with some effective mass, where this mass comes from.
No, I just mean it's double model. So first we suggest some interpretation of existing experiments, and this interpretation is not necessarily correct. For instance, neutrino has a direct mass which is small and sensory. And after that, we suggest how it could change under some conditions. So first, even we are not sure in the first point.
I think that I would interpret that the other way, which is that given how ignorant we are about the origin of neutrino mass, we should be very open-minded about the possibilities of it. And the assumption that this scale here is 10 to the 16 GeV is only coming because we see our gauge couplings in supersymmetric models unify, and we extrapolate, but then that seems like a natural scale for this.
Older is more to it. Direct neutrinos, you can take it at the same mass with the same scale.
That's true. But on the other hand, of course, once you do that, then you get dulls. I mean, the other problem, I mean, we're getting into a discussion about philosophy at this point, but then you have to say, well, why do you have large mixings in neutrinos and small mixing in quarks? Yeah.
I'm very sorry. Dima is waiting very patiently for a long time.
Well, I might have a silly question probably. So if you have new neutrino forces in some reasonable pictures for that, can there be some consequences for electron that could be detected in the loss of magnetometers, for example?
We've looked at that, and we haven't found anything. This is principally because for these theories to be technically natural, you always end up with, anytime you want to have induce a force for the electron, you always get a mass of the W boson in the denominator, because the W boson has to appear in the correction. But because of the way these theories work, you always end up with the mass of the neutrino in the numerator, setting the size of the scale. So you always end up with something like mu over mw, and that's really, really small. So any of the forces that we've thought about are really weak. Nothing that I think would be.
Well, maybe that's good, because otherwise this will be all ruled out already.
Second best thing that can happen to a theory, right?
Do you have any comments on slightly more recent models where the mass of neutrinos increases and they become non-relativistic at late time?
Oh, in these theories, that's typically what happens. They become non-relativistic.
Yeah.
But you still, for that, if you want to explain the dark energy, one species has to remain relativistic. But typically, that's what happens. Is that, and this is if you go back to this. Picture, you can sort of see what happens, which is that you have a scalar potential. This scalar potential wants to push the denominator to zero, right? The scalar potential is pushing A to zero. But when A goes to zero, 1 over A gets large. So basically, you think about the way the universe works in these kinds of models. The fact that there are neutrinos, the universe would minimize its energy if neutrinos were massless, right? So the universe wants those neutrinos to be massless. But you have a scalar potential that would like the neutrino masses to be, in this approximation, infinite. And so the universe is pushing one way, the scalar potential is pushing the other way, and that balances out. But as the universe then gets more and more dilute, there are fewer and fewer neutrinos around, so the thing which is pushing the neutrinos to be light is getting weaker and weaker, and the neutrinos then get heavier. So that's actually sort of the natural dynamics that you would expect in these models, that the neutrinos would start out very light and end up very heavy. The sterile neutrino is the one which starts out heavy and ends up.
So
you have a spectrum which goes like this. Really, it goes like this one moves very little and this one moves a lot.
There's also a cosmological constraint on total mass of neutrinos, which is about few EVs.
Right. So that's sort of the thing that would not apply in this model, right? Because that comes from the effect on looking at the power of dark matter at small scales, right? But the power of dark matter at small scales depends on what the total and non-clustering energy density is at early times, right? But here, you're assuming that the actual energy, the energy density in neutrinos is not varying like a cube, right? It's not diluting like matter. But since the neutrino mass is actually varying, you can't say, well, if I measure a neutrino, this is kind of the point, is that the best case scenario would be to get very, very good cosmological measurements of neutrino mass and find that they were in conflict with the values of masses that we measure here. And that would tell us that there should be some cosmological variation of neutrino mass.
So I have a question. So in your model, you have to decouple the non-relativistic neutrinos from the acceleron. Is that correct or not?
You mean in terms of thermal production?
Well, no, because to avoid the instability.
You don't have to decouple them. It's just they have to be, I can take the formula in your guys' paper, right, and then just ask if I have a quadratic potential, what's the mass of the neutrino, and if it ends up being relativistic, then they stay. I mean, it's just that it's hard to get some relativistic material to cluster, right?
That's true. That's fine. So, but if it's non-relativistic, but you know, two of them are non-relativistic.
Oh, the relativistic. Sorry. Oh, no, the non-relativistic ones can all still couple to the acceleron and still cluster. That won't necessarily induce a clustering of the subsequent relativistic ones. So yes, you would get some contribution of matter from the neutrino nuggets that you guys talked about.
So your picture is that there is also a coupling of non-relativistic ones to accelerons. So you have these neutrino nuggets of the heavy neutrinos.
That's right.
Going around.
That's right.
So, no questions. So we can break until
11:20.
Yeah, 11:20. 15 minutes. Yeah.